produced by Jeffrey Griselius, Joseph Cottrell, and Ken Fuller. This is Yes Music Podcast, episode 606. Steve Rosen, author and interviewer.
Hi, this is Trevor Rabin, and you're listening to the Yes Podcast.
Welcome to episode 606 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host, Mark Anthony Kay, will be along in a few moments. You can always get involved with the podcast yourself via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. On the YMP Facebook discussion group this week, a few of the highlights included Preston Frazier's review of Big Mistakes from Trevor Rabin's album Rio, an amazing shot of Chris Squire sitting on one of the Martin and Roger Dean Yes stage sets in 1975 in his back garden, which was posted by Jeffrey Mason, as well as Roger Dean sitting behind a model of House Complex at the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London, February 1976. Trevor Horn on the Rockonteurs podcast, spotted by Charlie Nolan. A lovely live shot of the Tales Tour in 1973, posted by Jeffrey. A review of Fish Out of Water by Chris Squire, added by Charlie Nolan. A shot of those face paints on the ABWH video, posted by Jeffrey. Flash with Peter Banks on the Midnight Special in 1973, added by Doug Curran and Jeffrey Mason. News from Doug of YesWorld.com's new stocks of Tales 50 items. And H.B. Peterson posted Rick Astley talking about doing the vocals for a new version of Owner of a Lonely Heart with Trevor Horn. Really? Stephen Lamb also sent in some very helpful audio feedback to do with last week's episode, and here he is.
Hi guys, Stephen here. Hope you're doing well. I'm just responding to your excellent episode last week comparing 90125 with the demos on 90124. What I thought I'd do would be to give you a little bit of context, to give you some thoughts about where Trevor was in his life at this point and how those demos kind of sounded the way they did, I think. So you have to remember that Trevor had been living in the London area. He had produced two albums for Chrysalis that were kind of linked with the new wave of British heavy metal at the time. So they're quite gritty. They're quite sophisticated in many ways. They sound like Trevor Rabin. He then meets John Kolodner of the fledgling Geffen label, who were just starting out, who says, come over to Los Angeles on a development deal. So he does that. Suddenly he and his wife are in Los Angeles and he's locked in his garage writing songs. And it's at this point that he writes all those things like Changes and Hold On and most importantly, Owner of a Lonely Heart. So next, he gets dropped by Geffen. Part of the reason for that is that he's asked to go back to London to rehearse with Asia. And he does that and he doesn't fit in. And he says, I don't want to do this. So Geffen say, well, sod you then. And so he then has all these demos. So he starts sending the demos out to record companies. He has other things bubbling as well. So he's offered a solo deal with RCA. He also had the possibility of a band with Keith Emerson and Jack Bruce, both of whom he really liked. So he was actually quite keen to be part of that. But Phil Carsons, bless him, who's the unsung hero of this whole period, as far as I'm concerned, gets a bit aggressive and says, stop messing around. He doesn't use the word messing, let's just say. And drags Trevor back to London and he ends up rehearsing with Chris and Alan and the rest is history. That's the context. I think the demos sound the way they do because he was trying to write hits. He wasn't writing for a solo album. He had been asked by Geffen to produce some hits. It might have ended up as a solo album. It's not what he was doing at the time. Just a quick comment also about cinema. The track rather than the band. I mean, there's lots to say about the band as well. In fact, there's lots to say about all of this. We could go down rabbit holes that could take us weeks. But anyway, let's not forget that Cinema, the track, was meant to be the opening section of the long piece, Time. Time was rehearsed extensively as Cinema, but by the time they started recording it for the album, it had been dropped as a whole piece. However, parts of it still remain in the public domain. So, for instance, Make It Easy was due to be part of Time. But I think you have to look at Cinema, the track, in the context of what was going to come next. And I think Time was a mixture of some song pieces and some other instrumental sections. That's it, really. There's lots of other things to say about 90125, but we could be here all week. Speak to you later. Bye.
Thank you, Stephen. As always, many thanks to everyone who got in touch in any way this week, including those who commented on last week's show notes. Ray Reithmeyer, Doug Curran, Miguel Falcao, Stephen Lamb, and Stephen Schinder.
Yes Music Podcast, 12 True Summers.
It's fantastic to welcome Steve Rosen onto the Yes Music Podcast this week. He is someone who's been a journalist, a music journalist for many years, and knew Edward Van Halen very well. He's just written a book about Edward, and it's called Tone Chaser, Understanding Edward, My 26-Year Journey with Edward Van Halen. So, welcome.
Thank you, Kevin. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm doing great. Doing great. Sunny. Well, actually a little overcast, Southern California at the moment, but getting into fall here, but very nice weather.
Lovely. Okay, then. Well, let's talk about your experiences. Gosh, that could be quite exciting. So you saw Yes several times in the early 70s, and we'll come back to that in a minute, but how did you first become aware of the band?
Oh, wow, that's a good question. So I've been a writer really since about mid-73. At that time, what would happen is, as you sort of rose up the ranks as a freelance writer, you would get on the mailing list for various labels, you know?
Right, yeah.
And so, you know, right, the idea was to get on all the mailing lists, so you were getting a ton of records, to be honest. With you, you know, and I only bring that up because I was into Yes before I started writing.
Right.
I mean, I loved Yes, you know, before I started writing and before, you know, those records were being sent to me. The period of music I love the best really is kind of that English stuff, man, you know, 65 to 69. Yeah. To me, that was the greatest period of music ever. I mean,
yes.
As much as there were, you know, a bunch of great American bands, you know, it was all that stuff, you know. So, I mean, I was aware of Yes, you know, and you know, King Crimson and all of that stuff. But there was always the knock against Yes. And I don't know if you guys heard that on your side. But, you know, well, it's, you know, how do you hum along to their music? And, you know, man, the time changes. And I think anybody who ever would have said that just really never understood the band, because at the heart of it, you know, if you strip away everything else and you strip away all the intricate time signatures, man, and the, you know, the figured bass parts, all that stuff. I mean, there are some really, really great songs there, you know?
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, man, long answer to a short question. you know, could have been their first tour here. I mean, I was going to like used record stores. And I knew that if I saw a Yes album, man, I was gonna get it. So I knew I had Yes albums in my collection. I had a pretty big record collection before I started writing.
Right.
I was gonna pick up a Yes album. I mean,
so what were those early jobs, writing jobs that you got? Were they with magazines or?
The very first writing gig I had, though, I don't know if you could call it a writing gig, I actually wrote for my high school newspaper.
Yeah. I'm sure most people start off like that.
Exactly. So I was a senior at Culver City High School, and the Centurion, our newspaper, basically a school newspaper, was always about, you know, scholastic activities and, you know, the drama club and, you know, the girls' softball team, whatever it was, you know. But I thought, you know what, I don't want to write about the school. I want to go write about music.
Yeah.
And so I asked our Journalism 101 teacher, Mrs. Carpenter, very sweet lady. I said, listen, I'd like to write about music. You know, I think all the students would, you know, dig that. She goes, yeah, that'd be great. So I just started going out to clubs. I wrote up a little letter. I typed up a little letter in the day and age of typewriters and pre-computers, you know. And I sent out this letter to all the clubs. And all the clubs said, sure, just show us the letter or let us know when you're going to come. And you can come see the bands. So I was going to the Whiskey. I remember seeing Beach Boys. This is like 71. Yeah. Chicago, really early on.
Yeah.
And then after high school, I went to UCLA, a university here, and took an English course, which was a nightmare. I hated that and left after the first year. And I write about that in the book and all of that thing. And just started, you know, kind of sending out stories to different publications. And I got something printed in a, it was like a little local, it was actually kind of like a softcore porn newspaper. I mean, it wasn't hardcore, but you right. You would buy the LA Star to turn to the back page and look for the massage ads, right?
Right.
You weren't buying the LA Star to glean any insightful information about the world of music. But I did a couple of reviews, and they printed them. I remember those reviews. One was on T-Rex, and the other was West Bruce and Lang.
Right.
And it just kind of grows from there. You know, you kind of use that as a stepping stone to say to the next publication, hey, look, I had a couple of reviews printed in, you know, the LA Star. Let me write for the LA Free Press, you know, a very cool underground newspaper at the time.
Right.
And, you know, Cream and Circus and eventually Guitar Player, you know. And let me just add one thing, Kevin, since this is a UK podcast here. Right after high school, I went to Europe and the UK with my buddy. We kind of hitchhiked around, you know, did a little bit of like the Jack Kerouac on the road thing, you know. And I met a lot of managers and publicists. Somehow the music editor for the LA Star had the names and numbers of all these managers.
Right.
So one of the very first interviews I ever did was with Gentle Giant. And this is like 73.
Yeah.
So first interview I ever did actually was Joe Cocker. So it was pretty amazing, man. So I was always enamored by the English thing, man. And I was able to visit Sounds, the editorial office when I was there, man. I thought, oh my God, this is the greatest. You know, I can die and go to heaven now. I mean, I'm in Sounds offices because I was reading Sounds, and when I could get copies of NME and Melody Maker,
yes.
You know, I mean, I just loved all that Anglophile stuff. So
brilliant. So what was the first Yes piece of writing you did then? Was it a review of an album or a live review?
Certainly I would have reviewed Yes, and I had mentioned this to you. Yes is playing the Forum.
Yes.
And so they must have been, you know, pretty huge by then.
Mm.
So this could have been, you know, Fragile.
Yeah.
Period by that time. And they were just... astonishing. You know, they were just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And afterwards, the label put together like a, you know, a backstage gathering, had all kinds of food. And I do remember, because I think one of them or maybe all of them were vegetarians.
Yes, that's right.
So it was all vegetarian dishes, you know, and I remember some of the flesh eating American press going, what the hell, you know, where are the burgers, you know? You know, and I remember the band was there, you know, they had come and they were hanging out. I kind of wanted to go and say hello, but, you know, I'd really only been writing for a little while at that point. I just, you know, I didn't quite have the nerve to go do that. So, you know, but, you know, they were there hanging out, you know. And then at one point I see somebody, and I think maybe it's Steve Howe or it's John Anderson, man, throw food at one of the other guys in the band. And, you know, I'm thinking, well, this, you know, they're just having some playful fun, you know, post-concert, they're letting loose, you know. But then some of the other members joined in, and it got pretty serious, man. I mean, this was not a fun food fight. This was kind of, hey, I'm going to throw a bowl of guacamole at you, you know, bowl and all. And I'm tossing my drink at you, you know, glass and all. I mean, it was pretty serious. That was the sense I had, you know, that these guys were not just kidding around. I would later come to understand that there was sort of, and I suppose it was that way in every great band, you know, that kind of that give and take, that pull and tug, you know, amongst members and creative directions.
Mm.
All I knew is, man, is this man was just got done headlining the Forum, and I really couldn't understand, you know, what they could have been, you know, unhappy about, you know.
Yes, who knows? But I mean, you went on to interview several of the band members over the years, and we could talk about that all day, of course. But are there a couple of interviews which stick out in your mind as particularly memorable?
No, the two of them really stick out.
Okay.
I actually interviewed Steve Howe twice.
Right.
And again, I thought Steve Howe, while he was not one of my favorite guitar players, only because, you know, that his style, you know, I mean, look, man, what he did was remarkable, and it was astonishing what he did, you know, kind of combining the jazz thing and the prog thing and the acoustic thing and all the instruments he could play. Look, I mean, I recognize his talent.
Yeah.
But for me, you know, I was more from the school of, like I said, man, you know, Clapton and Paul Kossoff and Robin Trower from Procol Harum, you know, and that was kind of where I was growing up, you know, kind of, you know, bigger and kind of louder. But I recognize Steve Howe as being a true artist, man, a real virtuoso. That being said, from the moment I got on the telephone with him, and this must be going back, this is going back a while, but it might have been, probably for one of his early solo records. I don't think it was a Yes conversation, though I would obviously bring up Yes.
Yeah.
And honestly, man, he was pretty nasty.
Oh, dear.
He was not very cordial. He was kind of sarcastic.
God.
You know, I asked questions that I thought were pretty incisive and probing, and he was just dismissive of him. I really loved his earlier stuff. Was the name of his band Tomorrow?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
I thought they did some amazing stuff, and I went back there, you know, because if you listen, I mean, certainly you know, Kevin, I mean, you can hear the roots of his playing being developed there, right? I mean, you know, those elements, at least to my ears. And I go, oh, you know, there was a solo you did. And did they have a song called White Bicycle? Yep. Or?
Yes, there was involved with that, yeah.
Right? I mean, I thought that was an amazing song. And I mentioned that. And he goes, oh, what the heck? You know, like, he wasn't cussing, but it was like, my God, why do you care about that? You know, and then I asked him a couple other things. And he goes, oh, what a stupid question.
Oh.
and you know, man, I mean, I just took it. I was just embarrassed.
Yeah.
Because I kind of prided myself on, you know, really reading up on the person I was interviewing. And I thought I had put together a pretty, you know, like I said, a pretty well-researched interview. And for him to say that, I mean, I was just so embarrassed by it, you know. And I said, God, man, I'm sorry, you know. But he was just angry the whole conversation. So I thought, okay, hey, we'll talk it up. He's having a bad day. I interviewed him again a couple of years later, I guess another solo record. And he was the same way. He was just not a very happy camper. And you ask if there were, you know, interviews. John Anderson, similarly, was not very nice. I don't know why he was kind of, again, it would have been one of his solo records, one of his early solo records, maybe his first solo record. I'm not real aware of years. I don't know what it was. As if he didn't want to be there, as if my questions were vacuous, which takes nothing away from my love for the band.
Yes.
Now, on the other side of that, I had the great good fortune to interview Trevor Rabin.
Right.
I understand he's not an original member, but obviously he was, you know, part of that huge record and the huge song. He was amazing.
Right.
Amazingly, you know, cordial. And
That actually says a lot, though, if you think about it, because, you know, you're talking to Steve and to John, and these guys have been in the band for so long and probably heard every question in the book 1,000 times. And then you have Trevor, who's new to this thing and new to Yes, and probably was, you know, excited to just be there talking about Yes and the music that he did with them, you know?
I believe that. And again, I really tried to steer clear of questions I knew they were going to be asked. Look, certainly it's impossible not to cover some of that ground. I mean, literally from the moment they got on the phone, these guys were not in good moods. And also, I need to mention Chris Squire, who was unbelievably sweet guy. And, you know, his passing, I thought, was horrific. I thought, you know, look, as much recognition as he gets, I don't think he really got the recognition he deserved. I mean, he brought all of those amazing elements. I mean, I hear kind of John Entwistle in his playing, a little bit of Jack Bruce, you know, but funneled through his unique mentality, you know, and his singing and his writing. My God, what a gifted bass player, you know. Without him, man, Yes is not Yes at all.
Yeah.
So, so two kind of angry guys, two sweet guys, and, you know, there you go. Later we'd find, you know, there was always that clashing of those guys and reunions and non-reunions. But hey, you know, again, creativity at that level, man, you're bound to run into those kinds of things. And I forgive them because they were such a brilliant band, you know.
Yeah.
When did you interview Bill Bruford, and what was he working on at the time?
Bill was pretty cool. He was pretty nice. A little bit edgy. You know, I recognize a little bit of that edge from the Steve Howe and John Anderson debacles, but basically pretty nice. I thought Bill Bruford, again, you know, Bill gets a lot of visibility, but I don't think he ever got the visibility that he should have. I mean, I thought his playing, you know, man, on Fragile, I mean, that was the textbook for that style of playing. The sound of his drums, he had one of the greatest snare sounds I have ever heard in my life. One of the few guys where you could, you know, you hear three hits of a Bruford snare and you know it's him. You know, I just thought he was amazing. As a little bit of a tie-in here, Edward Van Halen was a huge Bruford fan, a UK fan.
Yeah.
Loved them, you know, the Alan Holdsworth connection as well. I actually went with Ed to see a UK concert once. This is, Alan wasn't in the band.
That's right.
But yeah, Ed loved all that stuff, man. So I would interview Bill many years later, and this is a drum magazine called Drum Club. And I think they wanted a story about Bill Bruford. Bill had retired.
That's right, yeah.
Right? And I guess he had made that pretty well known. And so I was talking to him, and this time around, Bill was not quite so nice. Man, yeah. I don't know what it is about these Yes guys. But, you know, I said something about something, and he goes, oh, well, you don't believe that I'm retired? I go, no, man, I totally believe. I go, that's your decision. And he goes, yeah. Well, I am. I mean, he got really upset about it. You know? And I just tried to tell him, man, I thought you were an incredible drummer. And, yeah. You know, my God, everything you did. And, you know, and I could be misreading all this. I think Bill, and again, I don't know this for a fact, but I think he may have been alluding to the fact that, you know, by then, and again, I don't know when this was, this could have been, you know, so you now have this whole new generation of drummers coming up, right? Doing the double bass drum, double pedal thing and all that fast metal stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And I think somehow Bill felt, which is just amazing to me, somehow left behind, like what he had done or what he was going to do had no consequence.
The funny thing is, though, that there's an album that came out in the mid-90s with King Crimson that he was on called Thrak.
Right? Unbelievable
and
record.
On that press kit that they released, he mentioned, and I remember it like clear as day, it's even on the internet, you can see it there, they have an electric press kit for that album. He says that this album is equal to in heaviness to bands like Pantera. He says this is right from his lips. So he's aware of these bands, and maybe there's an element that you could be right about where he maybe felt a little bitter that, you know, there's this new generation of drummers that are coming up, getting all this recognition, and that he maybe felt that his stuff was still equal in heaviness in certain aspects to these drummers.
No, absolutely, Mark. Yeah, for him to name check Pantera and, you know, Vinnie Paul. Yeah, man, he was aware, which was just the weirdest thing to me. But I think John Bonham felt the same thing towards the end.
Oh, yeah.
Look, I know everything else, all the excess, but I think that he kind of felt that as well, which to me is just, you know, I mean, my God, you know, I mean, we know what he was responsible for. I mean, he was responsible for all of that metal stuff that would follow. But yeah, Bill somehow, man, you know, to announce your retirement in such an official way, it just seems strange to me. I mean, you know, typically musicians just sort of, you know, they wander off, you know, they'll put together their own music or you know, but it was like, yeah, he felt like he didn't measure up, which to me is just, my God, how unbelievably sad. The guy is, he's one of the all-time greats. I mean, he created that whole style. So I was interviewing Bill. He was in the UK. And so I called him, and my phone bill ended up being like $150 because I didn't have international calling. So I'm recording on cassette. I'm a real, trust me, man, I've been a lo-fi guy since day one. I mean, I never understood digital recorders or anything. So I'm recording on cassette, and we get done with the conversation, and I just rewind because I want to, you know, just see, you know, what the quality was like, you know, and I rewind. and there's nothing there.
Oh,
and
no.
I rewind a little further, and there's nothing there. Somehow, I had put on the B side, and I was at the end. I call him back. And this is after it's been like a little bit of a difficult conversation.
Yeah.
I go, Bill, I hate to say this.
Yeah.
I didn't record a conversation.
Oh,
and
no.
He got pretty angry. Look, justifiably so. As I'm talking to him, I hit play and I realized I had fast forwarded instead of reversed, and the conversation was there. I go, oh man, listen, I'm sorry. You know, I thought I was going to have to go, oh, well, next time, know what you're doing or something, you know. I don't know if he slammed the phone down, but he was not happy. But
not a happy bunny.
I actually think he would have done the conversation again. So,
yeah,
you know, maybe he was a little bit more forgiving than I gave him credit for.
Yeah. Brilliant.
On to your book.
Yeah.
How do you write a whole book about your friendship with a single person?
That's a good question. So we're talking about a 26-year span. It's funny because when I first started writing, I had no sense of how long or how short the book would be. So I just start writing. And what I loved doing was sort of exploding every moment. What I could have written about in a paragraph, I just really dived into very carefully.
Mm.
So one little episode, Edward smoking a cigarette or Edward stringing his guitar, you know, I could have written about it in one paragraph, but somehow it felt like it deserved more because they were such amazing moments. Look, not watching him smoke a cigarette per se, but being there in a room with Edward Van Halen, the greatest guitar player on the planet, while he smoked 8,000 cigarettes in a row, and I watched him, and I hate to say this, literally kill himself.
Yeah.
And I knew, and I write about it in the book, that these cigarettes were going to be his demise. Look, I'm not trying to be a doomsayer or anything, but I saw it. I saw how much he smoked. But, you know, stringing a guitar for Edward Van Halen was this unbelievable thing. Tuning a guitar, oh my God.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd write a page about what I could have written about in a paragraph. And that just sort of followed on. I put these little sections in the book called Note. And that was basically sort of this omniscient character looking down on this Steve Rosen character and commenting on what he was doing. So if this Steve Rosen character had asked a stupid question, the omniscient character would sit there for three paragraphs and go, Rosen, you moron, how could you ask Edward Van Halen that? How could you ask him that question? You know, what is wrong with you?
Yeah.
So I'm really, right, trying to bring the reader right there with me to feel every single thing I was feeling.
Yeah.
And to do that, you know, I had to go into this minutia. You know, man, 580 pages later is what it took to do that, you know. There were also a lot of actual interview stuff, interviews that had been printed before, but edited down for length reasons in magazines. So now there were the complete interviews, plus I would comment on the interviews. So there was a lot of that. All the different things that went on and, you know, hanging out with him up at his house and at my house, jamming with him, unbelievably enough, having him, you know, sort of play on some of my music, riding in a car with him, flying on airplanes, going to NAMM shows, going to a football game, you know, talking late at night. I mean, you know, getting high with him, drinking with him. You know, man, there was just so much. And I just felt like I had to cover every moment of it to get the story right. So just to back up just a little bit here. In 85, I approach Edward and say, Edward, there's going to be a lot of writers coming to you wanting to write your life story. You know, I would like to write that book. And he goes, yes, of course. You know, I can't think of anybody else who could write the story, you know, which touched me deeply. So in 1985, I began interviewing, you know, people for what was going to be his authorized biography. And one of the conversations I wanted to have with him was on his influences and music he was listening to.
Yes.
I could never specifically get him to sit down and do interviews for the book, which is why the book never happened. Edward always thought that a book came out on somebody when an artist's career was over.
Right.
He would say to me, well, if we do the book now, you know, the next album won't be part of the book and people will think my career is over. I go, Ed, the only person who thinks like that is you. You know, no one would ever think that. But yeah. But getting back to the question, so I never had that conversation in depth. But in our earlier conversation, just about music in general, yeah, man, he brought up Alan Holdsworth. He loved Holdsworth. Mm. You know, he loved UK. He loved Bruford, which is strange, you know, because it wasn't strange because Edward's taste in music was really kind of eclectic. You know, he loved bands like Budgie, who I love.
Yes,
I thought they were an amazing band.
Yeah.
You know, he mentioned Stray Dog, an incredible band. You know, but then he loved all the stuff we'd expect. Obviously, he loved Clapton and Cream.
Yeah.
You know, ZZ Top and Sabbath and Purple, Jeff Beck, but the kind of the later stuff, like the blow-by-blow stuff. Mm-hmm. Spirit, you know, he did some funk stuff, some James Brown. I do know that when Ed came over to my place, I lived just about 10 minutes from Edward up in the Hollywood Hills.
Yeah.
He lived in the expensive part in Coldwater Cabin.
Yes.
Coldwater Canyon. I lived in the more bohemia dirt road section, Laurel Canyon.
Yes.
But, you know, he'd come over and I had a huge record collection because, as I mentioned earlier, Mark, I had been on the mailing list for all the labels and they were now sending me all the monthly, you know, all the mailings, you know. So I had a huge record collection, like 7,000 or 8,000 records. I mean, it was really big.
Mm.
And I loved all those prog bands. So I remember Edward showing him my collection, you know, and him going, wow, you know, a lot of records. And I go, yeah, man. And I started pulling up records I thought that he would dig. I knew he was a big prog guy. So I pulled out records like Gong, you know, Soft Machine,
yes.
Genesis, which he'd obviously heard of because one of the names of his early bands was Genesis. But I don't know how far back with Genesis he went, you know. So I pulled out some early Genesis stuff, Supertramp. You know, Jethro Tull, you know, who people call prog band. I'm not so sure if I agree with that, but I pulled out some Tull records for him, you know, trying to, you know, maybe school him a little bit with the more obscure prog bands, you know, and I remember I gave him like a big stack of records. I pulled out stuff like Larry Carlton, Les Paul, Steely Dan. You know, a bunch of the English guitar players, you know, more obscure guys, you know, Rory Gallagher. Oh, God, a lot of those early blues guys, Kim Simmons, you know, stuff that maybe he hadn't heard about, but I figured he would have dug if he dug, you know, Clapton. I remember giving him literally, man, there must have been like 50 or 75 records. And so weeks went by kind of waiting to hear from Edward. Yeah, man, I listened to that Gong record. And how cool was that, man? Or, oh, that Soft Machine record, you know, I never heard anything. And I will bet you that he never ever listened to one record. Just the way he was. And he never gave me my records back. So, you know.
One thing that Eddie has never been clear on, at least that I've never read, and I'm sure that if anybody knows this, it'll be you, is I've never heard from Eddie's own lips what his favorite Van Halen album ever was. I know that he's always complained about certain ones, said that these ones were better than others. I know that he always had an issue with Fair Warning, that he had to go back by himself and do some of the guitar tracks because he didn't like the way it was going. But has he ever did he ever say to you what his favorite Van Halen album was?
I'm trying to remember. I don't think so. I do know that one of his favorite songs was Light Up the Sky.
Oh, great.
Yeah, he really loved that song. You know, you bring up Fair Warning. Yeah, Ed may have groused about going back to have to redo Fair Warning, but he was really, really proud of that record. You know, again, it's the first time that he actually did have time to sit down and layer guitars. I mean, you hear more tracks of guitars on that record than any previous record, you know, and you really hear Edward emerging truly as an orchestrator and, you know, how he's fitting guitar parts together. I mean, his solos, in fact, he said, I'm happy with every solo on that record. So I don't know, man, you know, as an unspoken thing. I mean, I think if you walked up to him and said, Ed, you know, is Fear Wanting your favorite record? He'd say, well, yeah, maybe. You know what I mean? Because I don't really, really know if he ever had one. I mean, I don't really think it would have been like any of the Sammy Hagar era stuff. He was proud of 1984 because, you know, represented, you know, again, he's taking more of a hands-on approach to the production, right? He's now got his own 5150 studio. he can hang out in the studio all night with Don Landy, the engineer, and he can tweak guitar tones. And the band is elevated. You know, to me, 1984 is kind of like analogous kind of, you know, Supertramp's crime of the century. You know what I mean? It's like,
you know,
here's this great band that's now become a really important band, and the sound of the band and the songwriting. I don't think Edward would have looked at 1984 as that one either. You know, maybe if you pinned him down again, this is me just guessing, it may have been the first record, only because it was first record. I can tell you that for those first two records and those first two tours, that's when Record was the happiest. Man, he was just, you know, he's this kid who's just, you know, gone from playing, you know, for 200 people the Whiskey, and now he's out there on the road with Journey and Black Sabbath, you know, his heroes. And then he goes off and does that Day on the Green show with AC/DC, who he loved. Bon Scott was his favorite singer, and, you know, telling me, how do I go on after those guys, you know? And you know, he's this young kid, and my God, he's being hailed as this great guitar player. Yeah, he was happy those first two records. So I don't know, man. You know, I would like to say maybe it was the first record for him, but he loved Fair Warning. You know, he loved those solos. And he was always the kind of guy that if you said, oh, man, you know, that, you know, the second record, man, was so much more mature than the first. And I said that once to him, and oh, my God, what a mistake that was. He goes, well, you know, that sounds like I'm, you know, like I'm doing something, you know, on purpose, or I know what I'm doing, you know, that's not the case at all, you know. And sometimes when you're trying to pay Edward a compliment about his music, like my music can't be measured, not in an ego way, but my music can't be measured, you know, in a way like, oh, it's more mature. It's just, you know, an organic thing, and that's what I'm doing, you know. So I had to be careful, you know, sometimes what I would say, you know. And that's when the guy in the notes section would look down and said, Rosen, why the f*** did you say that to him? Don't call his music mature. He's going to jump on you, you know. So, yeah.
Oh, that's great stuff. Well, I just want to read a couple of the quotes from the back of your book. And one says, so many great stories, so many thoughtful insights, a really honest and human account with great colour and context. Wonderful writing, says Paul Branigan. And he wrote Eruption, the Eddie Van Halen story, so he knows what he's talking about, that's for sure. So can you sum it up then, please? Can you sum up Edward as a person and as a musician for you?
You know, people have come back to me, and more than one person has used the word, and you sort of hinted at it, Kevin, and they said the book humanized him. What I was trying to do, I suppose at a point, I don't know if I was trying, I don't know if that's the right word, but what ended up happening is portraying Edward as, yes, as this, as a human being, and not just Edward, this extraordinary musician. We all knew that he was an extraordinary musician, you know. Paul Branigan, you know, this guy, what a fantastic writer. My God, he is such a great writer, man. And it goes back to that English thing. His writing is so English. I always wanted that feel in my writing. I could never get it, but what a beautiful writer. And I thank him because he gave me a very nice compliment in his book, you know, talks about more about Edward the musician. And Brad Talinsky and Chris Gill's book talks about Edward the musician and the guitars he used and, you know, that kind of thing. And those are very important books. So how do I encapsulate it? Well, I suppose it took me 580 pages to come up with some rough idea. I can tell you that in some respects, he was an incredibly strong person. He really knew who he was. That for him, making music and being on stage was second nature. I don't think Edward ever had a case of nerves in his life. Though I did ask him, you know, hey, man, when you did that Day on the Green show, what was that like? He goes, oh, man, I was nervous, you know. How do I play in front of those guys? But I think that was maybe the only time he was ever nervous in his life. On the other side of that, you know, like every other, you know, human being in the world, he was fragile. He had his frailties. He knew that he was a very good guitar player, but never, not one time did I ever hear him say, dude, is that the greatest fucking solo you ever heard? God, that was a great solo I played, wasn't it? Or God, that solo that Blackmore does, man, this eats him up. He never said that. Look, he may have taken a shot at Richie, because Richie treated him like garbage, you know. Right. When I write about that, or he might have taken a, you know, sort of a passing shot at guitar players who insulted him back in the day. But he never talked like that, and he never looked at his own playing that way.
Yeah.
On the other side of that, I think he was always a little unsure about how the records were going to be received, you know, and again, I talk about, you know, saying a record, you know, was more mature, and he gets insulted by that. I once said, after hearing a solo, it was one of the Fair Warning solos, hear about it later, just some amazing solo. And I remember that Edward got angry if I went overboard. So I go, yeah, that was really good. You know, almost purposely trying to be understated.
Yes.
And he said to me, he goes, well, didn't you think it was good, man? I thought it was a really good solo. It was like, oh my God. Uh-huh. One, it was such a, he was showing such respect to me that he would care about my opinion enough that he thought I wasn't, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that comes from this, you know, this little bit of an insecure place in him.
Yeah.
Look, we all look at Edward Van Halen, this legend, this icon, this genius, as how could he possibly be insecure or fragile? He was.
You know,
he just had this other brilliant side, you know. And I suppose I look at a part of him the same way as I look on people like, you know, Jimi Hendrix and John Bonham and Keith Moon and Janis Joplin, these unbelievably gifted people. And why do they all succumb to drugs and alcohol?
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. My theory, and again, you know, it could be totally wrong. Maybe they all had flawed upbringings, or I don't know.
Yeah.
But I don't know, man. I think creativity at that level somehow, you know, it has to be balanced with something, and maybe it's that thing that has to be fed with drugs and alcohol. I don't know, but you know, I don't know if extraordinarily happy, self-fulfilled people get addicted to those things. I don't know. Could be wrong. But, you know, man. So in answer to your question, man, he was a really complex human being.
Yes.
I wish I'd had more time to talk to him back in 85, you know, and I would have, you know, we could have gotten deeper into these conversations. A lot of this is revealed in what I call the Twilight Tapes in my book. And these are the deeper dives into the conversations, into Edward as a human, you know, having a relationship with his family and with his mother and his brother. And, you know, I hopefully I've shed some light on that and humanized him, you know, in some way. So, yeah, man, tough question.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you very much for coming to talk to us about that. And we'll put the link to your new book in the show notes for this episode. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed.
Absolutely, man. That was great. It was great speaking with you. Yeah, man. Look forward to the link for sure.
Yes Music Podcast, 600 episodes.
Just before we go, here are the YMP producers and half the patrons. Yes Music Podcast producers are Joseph Cottrell, Ken Fuller and Jeffrey Griselius. And half of the Yes Music Podcast patrons are Mark Baggs, John Cowan, John Parry, Dave Owen, Simon Barrow, Steve Scott, Terence Sadler, Steve Dill, Robert Naser, Fergus Cubbage, William Hayes, Jeff Bailey, Stephen Raw, Lobate Scarp, Jeffrey Mason, Dave Watkinson, Tim Stannard, Robert Vanderveer, Brian Sullivan, David Pannell, Jamie McQuinn, Miguel Falcao, Paul Tomei, Michael O'Connor, Brian Harris, H.B. Peterson, and Guy de Rome. So, of course, as always, thank you very much indeed to all those patrons and producers. They help keep the lights on here at YMP Towers. And if you'd like to join them, please do head over to patreon.com, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast, or click on the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening so much once again. We hope to be back next week with Miguel Falcao, so look forward to that. And in the meantime, please do keep listening and getting involved via X, Facebook, or Instagram. So until next time, just remember, Whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.